One really interesting thing that we've noticed is if you have a founding team that have had an exit in the 50 to 200-ish million dollar range, those founders tend to be the hungriest. If you have had a massive level of success, the to Joe's point, like staying up at 1 o'clock when you have like millions of dollars in your bank account, it's a little harder to do versus if you're like, hey, we got to build something here and kind of complete the job that we did in the last company.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a sports reference. I don't know if you guys are into boxing or UFC, but at one point, McGregor and Floyd Mayweather fought, and McGregor ended up making like 9 figures on a payday. And the UFC chairman guy, Dana White, was like, dude, after making that much money, it's kind of hard to convince somebody to come back and get punched in the face for a living. And so I would imagine the same thing goes for founders. They hit a big exit. They're probably not going to want to go stay up till Friday till 1 a.m. Trying to take care of a production outage. So you got to have some demonstration of success, but also some carrot still hanging on the stick that they're gunning after.
Luckily, McGregor has a high burn lifestyle, so he's actually going to be back in the ring later this year.
That's a good point.
This is true. I don't think Mayweather is immune to that statement either.
Hello, and welcome to Coffee with Coalesce, a monthly podcast about all things data and the trends in technology transforming our industry. I'm Armand Petrosian, CEO of Coalesce, and here with me is my co-founder and CTO, Satish Jayanthi. Together, we'll be your host for the next hour. Why don't we get started with some intros? So I think just by way of introduction, we got two stars of the show today. Satish and I are mostly here just to interview you both, but obviously Coalesce announced their Series B just a couple weeks ago. Big announcement for us, you two being investors in the company. I thought, what better way to use your time than to open this up to an audience and actually ask you some questions for things that people are very curious about when it comes to the venture capital industry, where the data industry is headed, where the AI industry is headed. A bunch of questions for you guys, but why don't you kick things off and just introduce yourself. Let's start with Joe.
Perfect. Hey, I'm Joe Floyd. I'm a general partner at Emergence Capital. We are a focused fund that only does early stage enterprise software. That is it.
Saad, what about you?
Thanks, Ramon and Satish. I'm Saad Siddiqui. I'm a general partner at Telstra Ventures. And we manage around $1 billion in total assets across 3 funds. I do a lot of work in the data infrastructure space, given my background at Cisco and Informatica. And pretty excited to be here and joining you all on this journey.
Sweet. First question, is Salesforce going to buy Informatica?
I was just about to ask. I heard that they abandoned those dogs.
No comment.
We'll come back to it. Satish, you want to do a quick intro and I can take it? We can get rolling?
Sure. Satish Jayanthi, CTO, co-founder. Armand and I working on this endeavor.
Sweet. Co-founder as well, CEO over here at Coalesce. Couldn't be more excited to have you two on as guests. I think typically speaking, we've had tons of different founders within the data industry, different thought leaders, but this is the first time we've opened it up to the venture capital industry. And I think generally speaking, there's been so much madness over the course of the past 3 years in venture capital between like pandemonium fundraising time, 2021, early 2022, screeching halt on that, then AI being introduced, it becoming kind of another high growth, highly funded segment in the midst of a lot of madness as people try to kind of recollect where they're at if they're not in that segment. So I've got a handful of questions. I think the first piece is just curious, both of you have been in this game for a bit, and from your perspectives, just thinking back, say 5-6 years ago, the data industry looked completely different. AI was not what it is today. It was more of a buzzword. And so I'm curious, like when you were, think back to Joe or Saad 5 or 6 years ago, what things did you think were going to happen that did? And what things did you not expect were going to happen that did? So maybe Saad, I'll start with you.
Yeah. So five, six years ago was like a very interesting time. We were kind of like on the tail end of the Hadoop life, right? So you had a bunch of really interesting companies that came up and honestly got swept by the whole cloud movement really quickly. We started seeing the early wins and traction on Snowflake and Databricks. Like Amazon and Google and Microsoft were also like in the mix, but not in as significant a way as they are now. And in some ways it was like a very shaky ground because you had these massive platform shifts that were sort of happening. Mm-hmm. And on the back of that, I personally invested in a company called Trifacta, which was bought by Alteryx in the data quality space. The main thesis at the time was like, as these platform shifts are happening, you need a standardized sort of format around data. And interestingly enough, that sort of has, it's the importance of that has continued to today. And we can talk about that here in a little bit. But I think just generally, it was sort of really interesting to see now that the dust has settled and the world has sort of like now knows what the data platforms are of the future, what are the tooling and infrastructure that's needed to make everyone productive? So yeah, that's sort of like where I think the world was about 5-6 years ago, and how I sort of think about things today.
Was there anything that you didn't see coming that happened throughout that process, or is there any curveballs that came at you throughout? I mean, certainly I remember
the
big data movement, like Hadoop on-premise, like proposed tons of elasticity, but really difficult levels of usability, opened up the opportunity for the cloud and cloud data warehouses like Snowflake to emerge and become dominant. But was there any other curveballs that were thrown at you through that?
To be very open, I have been, this is sort of like tells you like as venture capitalists, you should never listen to me. Like you should definitely listen to me, not me. I was like very surprised at how quickly Snowflake gained traction. I was actually very nervous. I came across an opportunity to invest in the company and ended up not investing. And because I was worried about how Snowflake was built on Amazon and Amazon having a competitive product, I was very worried, and like just profitability wise and the cash burn and everything else was really like scary at that moment in time. Yeah. But to be very open, there's a bunch of things that I missed. The big thing I missed was like how much people love the product.
Right.
And that's the piece I didn't appreciate as much as I do now. So that was like one of my biggest sort of surprises is like, hey, like for a bunch of different reasons, I passed on the opportunity, but at the same time, like it's sort of like now like one of the more sort of like pivotal technologies for the modern data stack.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've got more questions on some of the thought processes you've gone through for certain investments or passed up on investments. Joe, you know, at Emergence, you know, from my perspective, going through fundraising, both the A and the B, I've gained an appreciation for the company largely around its thesis-driven approach. And it seems like a really big portion of the investments come from that. What things were you thinking about 5 or 6 years ago that you saw come to reality, or where were things wrong, or what curveballs were thrown in your direction?
Yeah, I mean, Saad, don't feel bad. Redshift was the dominant cloud data warehouse. And it's actually kind of shocking how quickly Snowflake destroyed them, right? I don't think I saw that the rise of Snowflake at the same pace that actually happened in reality. The thing that I was focused on was once Snowflake became the dominant player, like what are all of the parts of that kind of modern data stack that that need to be built out, knowing that we already had the benefit of watching it happen on-prem. And like, we already saw all of that same tooling. So it was almost like, okay, how do we just find the next gen version of that? Because the on-prem folks aren't going to make the transition just in the same way that with applications, it's extremely rare that any of the on-prem winners actually built a great cloud application. So that was our core thesis. And then we started looking at all of the various parts of that tooling stack and trying to pick the winners. And so certain categories, winners emerged a little earlier, like maybe Fivetran on the E part of ELT. But then other categories were just extremely, let's just say, crowded, right? Some of the, you know, data monitoring, et cetera, would have 12 startups that were all, you know, great founders, had raised seeds and series A's, and they were just going to beat each other up. And so for us, it was all about finding a category that was both large enough and exciting enough within the modern data stack, but also didn't have 10 great teams going after it.
Yeah.
And I know for Emergence, that was our thesis. And when we met Armand and Satish, it was just such a perfect fit for the thesis, and really loved the kind of founder problem fit. That's what we always talk about. Finding founders who have an unfair advantage where they understand the problem and have also seen the previous gen of technology. So they know the mistakes that they want to avoid the second time they build it. That's been a recipe for success for us, and just excited we got to meet you at the right time.
That's awesome. Satish, you had a question around team as well. And by the way, we've got people from all over, like looks like London, Quebec, Des Moines, Iowa, Ontario. If anybody's got questions in the audience as you're tuning in for either Sod or Joe or even Satish or myself, feel free to hit the comments. But Satish, you brought up something behind the scenes around teams in general that Joe touched on a little bit there. What was it? Were you curious about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes in the same lines what Joe was kind of alluding to, you know, what they look in the founding team. You know, when you guys are looking at a team, you're looking at investment. Here's the technology. You know, that's one thing, one aspect of it, of course, an important aspect. But also the people who are, you know, pitching this, people who are going to be responsible to deliver this successfully. What do you guys kind of typically look in that founding team?
Joe, do you want to start? I'm happy to add on if you
sure, like. Sure, yeah. So kind of that unfair advantage, right? And then for me, it's like it is such a hard thing to do to build a startup. And so you're looking for people who have maniacal intensity. And so it can't just be about making money. And for I know for you two, it's about solving a problem that is near and dear to your heart and building something valuable for the community. And that's the only thing that's going to keep you going at 1 a.m. on Friday when something bad happens. So, you know, that's what we look for.
Yeah.
And I think just to add to Joe, what we sort of spend a lot of time on is kind of like understanding like the chip on the shoulder. Like founders that have had some level of success, but they felt like their job was unfinished in their last journey. That's a big thing, right? Like when you've had a little bit of success, but you're like, you know what, we could have done better.
Yeah.
And that's something that we look for as well. And then the ability to hire well across the board. I think in some ways the founders have to be incredible storytellers and have to be able to attract the right talent and motivate them and attract the right capital and to empower that vision. In some ways, like the technology is really critical, but at the same time, like it's the people behind it. And if you can bring together the best possible team, it's that's the thing that we kind of look for is like, is everyone an A player across the team?
That makes sense. So not just the founding team, but also their ability to recruit similar minded people that are A plus execs, ICs all across the board.
Yeah.
I remember that being part of the conversations as we went through the Series B with you, Saad. I'm surprised you didn't bring up that Telstra has their own internal analytics project that helps flag certain companies that they see as highly potential successful businesses. That was one of the coolest things that I learned about you guys going through the process was that you basically have a data warehouse that you built for startups and grading them on.
Yeah. And one really interesting thing that we've noticed is if you have a founding team that have had an exit in the 50 to 200-ish million dollar range, those founders tend to be the hungriest, And if you have had a massive level of success, the to Joe's point, like staying up at 1 o'clock when you have like millions of dollars in your bank account, it's a little harder to do. Versus if you're like, hey, we got to build something here and kind of complete the job that we did in the last company.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a sports reference. I don't know if you guys are into boxing or UFC, but at one point, McGregor and Floyd Mayweather fought, and McGregor ended up making like 9 figures on a payday. And the UFC chairman guy, Dana White, was like, dude, after making that much money, it's kind of hard to convince somebody to come back and get punched in the face for a living. And so I would imagine the same thing goes for founders. They hit a big exit. They're probably not going to want to go stay up till Friday till 1 a.m. Trying to take care of a production outage. So you got to have some demonstration of success, but also some carrot still hanging on the stick that they're gunning after.
Luckily, McGregor has a high burn lifestyle, so he's actually going to be back in the ring later this year.
That's a good point.
This is true. I don't think Mayweather is immune to that statement either. So, cool. That's super helpful. I think it sounds like you both. I mean, obviously, so from your background, you were in the data space before becoming a VC. Joe, you've spent a ton of time with different data companies. AI certainly become a huge focal point. Not just for like general population, but also even in the data industry. I guess, what do you two see the relationship being between data and AI being LLMs? Like, is this going to be a strong synergy here? Do you see it being a huge competitive advantage for the parts of the modern data stack that you've looked at that historically you may have passed up on investments for? Are there going to be newcomers that come into each part of the stack?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, everyone was saying data is the new oil, right? I hated that phrase. But I love what it stands for, which is, I mean, having well-annotated, structured data is critical to building LLMs, especially building effective ones and building them cost-effectively.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing this utter surge in companies that can help provide that. Think about the two things that even the Metas of the world are running out of. It's good, clean data and compute. And so those are the two things that AI needs the most right now.
Yeah, I think double-clicking on what Joe said, from our perspective, it's LLMs need to be trained on like valuable data, not just any data. Mm-hmm. So if you can kind of provide data in a way that can train LLMs to the end result that the enterprises or users looking for, that's sort of like the piece that's going to make, one, the technology significantly better, and two, train faster on the data sets that they need to be trained on. So to me, it's like the plumbing that's needed to like have the LLM vision come true. And it's sort of like we're starting to see issues around hallucination and a bunch of other stuff like that, which just sort of like shows that the data sets the models have been trained on weren't as tailored to the end results. So if you want to get rid of hallucinations, this is sort of like critical technology for that.
That's super interesting. I was going to ask to go a layer deeper. Like, there's obviously so much hype around Gen AI right now in general. And like behind the scenes, like I've talked to Joe, I've talked to you, Saad, about certain businesses that are leveraging LLMs or have focus on Gen AI. And from my perspective, it's a little bit difficult to determine which companies actually have a defendable value proposition, or at least one that can't be replicated easily by other players. And there's like jokes around people having built an entire company as a wrapper on top of OpenAI or something along those lines. So when you go through conversations with founders, when you go through, I'm sure there's a ton of companies that are like being born right now in this space. How do you determine whether or not it's actually a defendable product architecture, a defendable business that couldn't just be easily replicated by anybody else? Like, what's the process look like for you two to determine that in this space in particular?
Yeah. So from my perspective, I am a big believer in the commoditization of LLM technology.
Yeah.
And like with a bunch of these open source models like Llama out there, like they're just getting better over time. The value, like they're going to provide a tremendous amount of value to anyone that's using them. But just from an economic value perspective, I sort of struggle to see that over time. I suspect like companies like OpenAI and Anthropic may end up having a bit of price pressure because like the gap between the open source and their models may start decreasing. And there's just such a massive cost advantage on the open source side. So what ends up happening is like, who are the main users, right? And who are the main folks that are going to be delivering like new products and services to their end customers using these technologies? That's a very critical area for us. And the thing that sort of like ends up being defensible over time is unique data sets. Mm-hmm. So if you've built an application that is able to harness a unique data set that isn't within Salesforce or ServiceNow or some of the big SaaS platforms, I think you can create a tremendous amount of equity value.
That makes sense. Joe, anything to add there? Any other thoughts?
Yeah, the two things that we look for are our workflow and distribution. So if you've built a product that improves the overall workflow for that end user, or if you already have an existing application that has killer workflow and you can layer on Gen AI to it, either of those are a sustainable advantage. And then with distribution, this is one where Gen AI actually benefits growth stage companies over startups. But if you already have distribution and you can layer on Gen AI on top, that's also going to be a sustainable advantage. So those are the two things we look at with applications.
Got it. Do you guys remember where you were when you first played with the chatbot for the first time? Or do you remember what that experience was like? Like what went through your head?
It wasn't a Gen AI chatbot.
Okay. A Gen AI chatbot. Do you remember the first time interacting with one of those and like where your mind was at? Like, was it, what was racing through your head in that moment?
I was in Las Vegas.
Okay, you do remember.
It was like 1 a.m. and someone else pulled out.
I'm sure you were totally sober.
Completely stone cold sober at a bar. And a friend pulled out a phone and was showing us like the early beta of what would become ChatGPT like 6 months later.
Oh, wow.
And we were inputting like the craziest prompts to create, have a short story created about midgets taking over the White House. So that's,
wow.
that was my first experience with it.
So you got some narrative in a second. You're like, what the hell is this? Uh-huh. Probably became a fuzzy memory the next morning, but you're like, this is for real.
Yep.
Stan, what about you?
So it, in a very interesting way. So my girlfriend was working on like one of her papers for her master's. And I was like, you know what? I don't know anything about speech language pathology, but like, let me see if this thing can help. Like, I've heard enough good things about ChatGPT. Yeah. Literally wrote her entire essay. I didn't tell her initially that like, hey, I came up, like I used technology for this.
Yeah.
Hey, okay, here you go. I did some research and I came up with this.
That's insane. What was her feedback? And did you ever let her know the truth?
I think she's figured it out by now.
She's figured it out. Okay. This is like right at the forefront before it was like
everybody. Like no one knew about ChatGPT or anything like that. Yeah.
Your son probably does this all the time at college.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They all do that. I mean, I was speaking to my daughter yesterday. It was high school. And she was going, oh, now they're going to detect, you know, your essays, they can find out. And so what they do is she was going through like 10 applications and one is a detector, one will rewrite and they put their own stuff. So 10 steps to make sure that it's undetectable. And I was joking, you're better off just writing the essay properly in the first place.
I saw online that teachers are putting sentences in white ink in their prompts, like their essay prompts, so that if you copy and paste it right into ChatGPT, something in the white ink will say, like, you know, include the word Armand in this essay.
Wow.
So it's a very surreptitious way to figure out if an LLM is actually writing the essay.
That's clever. I'm glad I'm not in school anymore. I'll stick to running a company. that's helpful to know, at least what the perspective is on how you guys look at a defendable moat, if you will, within companies. Joe, at one point you mentioned that this, like, just Gen AI in general felt like it was the fourth platform shift that you've seen in the industry throughout your career as an investor. What were the other three? And this was probably 6 or 7 months ago when you shared this with me, maybe a little bit longer. Do you feel like this is of similar magnitude of those other platform shifts, or greater or smaller? Like, where does it land on the scale?
Yeah, it's the first platform shift was kind of mainframe to PC, and then PC to cloud to mobile.
Okay.
And with each of those shifts, you just have massive opportunity created, as some people will be winners and some people will be losers. Mm-hmm. Gen AI is going to be the exact same way, except potentially even bigger and even faster, because each of those movements happened bigger and faster. And with what I'm seeing, I'm on an investor in one of the kind of top AI infra companies called Together AI. Mm-hmm. We're seeing adoption at a faster rate than any cloud applications I ever saw. Like, this is, I mean, we were investors in Zoom, and Together's blowing away Zoom's numbers at the same stage. It's incredibly impressive. And it's just, people see this as a tidal wave change on how software is going to be produced and consumed, everything.
That's crazy, especially because you guys were in Zoom clearly throughout the pandemic when everybody was going to use Zoom. Purely, I mean, out of necessity, basically, at that point. So,
well, I mean, just think ChatGPT.
Just Charmander. He can't be stopped, man.
Gotta catch them all.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd never asked you, like, about the other platform shifts you'd seen. So it's basically mainframe PC, PC cloud, cloud mobile, and then now Gen AI. Like, that's pretty massive magnitude. So do you see this based on the experience with Together AI, or just in general being a bigger tidal wave than any of those previous three then?
I mean, I just think it has the potential to be bigger, because you could see ways that Gen AI will interrupt service industries. And so some of those markets are just so massive, and they've been insulated.
Yeah.
But I don't think they will be for long.
Saad, do you think, it does feel like there's quite a large degree of hype right now in Gen AI in general. And, like, my assumption is that a lot of these investments aren't going to end up panning out with, like, all the different companies that are fundraising. Like, yep. is it fair to say, similar to how 2021 and 2022 played out? Like, is there a part of this that's a bubble? Are we going into this eyes wide open? Like, what's the feedback there on AI investments in general?
I think it's I agree with Joe on one element, which is, like, we're seeing massive disruption across the entire, like, from an economic level. There's almost, like, no industry that is not going to get impacted. Like, everything from agriculture to manufacturing is going to get impacted in a way, with these technologies, in a way that technologies haven't touched in the past. So there is going to be a massive amount of equity value that's going to be created here. The other thing I sort of agree with Joe on is, like, distribution is going to be critical, because distribution gives you access to data sets that you can't get, that you need to train the language learning models on. Mm-hmm. I do worry about, like, generally speaking, because of the massive inflow of capital in companies that are somewhat unproven, it's sort of like you almost need to be lucky in some ways. It's very hard to figure out whose nerd is the smartest in some ways.
Yeah.
You don't have distribution in a lot of infrastructure companies, and you may not even have a product. So you're kind of, like, wondering over time, like, hey, can this team build a technology that can get a distribution advantage over time? And in some ways, I think commercial traction is going to be more valuable than technology innovation. because that's going to feed into like how well someone's able to acquire data and then train their infrastructure or build an infrastructure for those use cases or build a technology in some cases as well. And the other thing that I sort of think about a lot is like, I really like how you guys sort of were talking about the platform shifts over time. And I sort of think about mobile the mobile revolution, right? Like no one disagrees there. Like it was one of the biggest shifts of all time. And when I think about it, like from an infrastructure landscape, like on the mobile side, we sort of saw like some really interesting companies come out, right? Like there were companies that were in the, if you kind of like total up everything, you're probably in the $50 to $100 billion total market cap range, right? And then on the applications, they added approximately, you had companies like Uber and DoorDash and a bunch of other companies like that come up that were utilizing these technologies, that the equity value there was closer to $500 billion. Right. But big platforms like Microsoft, Amazon, Google added $4 trillion in market cap for the mobile shift. So if you're empowering those platforms in some ways, I think you can build a really big business. And in some ways, I kind of think about the Gen AI move in a similar way, because those guys have all the distribution in the world. So if you can empower them, you can kind of like latch onto their coattails and then they'll pull you up and you can kind of create some really interesting value there.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it feels like right now, at least with some of the customers I've spoken to, certainly the ones that are on the cutting edge of things are in a unique position because executives at their company are really open to funding AI initiatives right now. And I think there was a large period of time where that was the case for data initiatives. And then just like over things, you know, I think just in the past couple of years, like there's been a little bit of fluctuation in general with like public markets and uncertainty. But if anything, AI initiatives are given another massive resurgence to data teams in general, because as long as the executives recognize the whatever you're trying to do in AI is only going to be as good as the data that you're pulling it from, then that effectively turns into a data and AI movement and a data and AI investment. And so it's interesting. I'm very curious to see what use cases evolve or what value comes out of it, especially in the data engineering communities. I think it's still early right now, but there's a ton of talks around it. And I don't imagine it's going to end up like the big data movement that we saw, Saad, like the ones that you had a first class seat into. I do see this leading to a lot of successful projects versus them becoming things that blow back. And so, yeah, I'm curious to see how that evolves. What are some of the other signs that you guys see with the startup that make you say like, hey, this company's here to stay? Like this is like a signal, a really clear signal that this business is legit, this business is going to be successful outside of the team. Like, are there any other of your favorite signals that you see within a business?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking for a large market, hopefully undergoing some sort of, you know, tailwinds or technological shift. I'm looking for great metrics. So companies like Coalesce that are growing extremely fast are always impressive. And I think a lot about long-term moat. So these are the M's: market, metrics, management, and moat. I'm looking for companies that are going to build something defensible long-term. So, you know, when I'm thinking about Coalesce, like if people are using Coalesce to build all the transformations in their cloud data warehouse, and that's then running all of their business, mm-hmm. that's a pretty strong competitive position. So that's what we look at.
Yeah, I remember you saying you get really excited about enterprise plays as well at one point in the early stages of us working together, just seeing like big brands, big companies, you know, with sophisticated use cases. At least in our scenario, that was one of the attractive components to the investment on your end. Yep. Saad, what about you? What certain things? I'm assuming you don't have four M's for me, but you got something.
We think about it the same way as Joe and the Emergence teams do. But also, like, we also kind of like, I think the thing that Coalesce is a big example of is like customer love and customers sort of using the product on a daily basis. So like kind of thinking through like, what does the usage metrics sort of look like? Yeah. And is this like someone's like, does someone like live in this product? Yeah. And how many of those people are there in the world? And we sort of saw this massive market, there's a massive market of people that are starting to do transformations within Snowflake and then into other platforms as well. And I think this is kind of more specific to the broader ETL side of things or ELT side of things is like when I sort of joined Informatica almost a decade ago, a little over a decade ago, we were selling ETL, right? Like a big platform, every process was happening before like the data landed in the data warehouse. Now like that whole process is being upended, and because people need more flexible ways of doing things, that's sort of like where for me it was like really compelling to sort of see a bunch of different people building out use cases. I think it was like really fascinating for me to sort of learn about like some customers that are like, hey, we're doing data quality stuff with Coalesce, we're doing data pipeline and data observability stuff with Coalesce. I mean, that's not what the product is meant for, but they were impressed enough with the technology where they're kind of building their own use cases and living within the product, which was really fascinating to me. We don't see that very often.
That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I think we've also seen from our founders' perspectives, our customers extend off our platform to do things that we weren't intending for it to do. I mean, we knew we wanted to support like pretty much anything that was possible on Snowflake. That was the main thinking, but they've impressed us with the way that they've navigated the platform and extended off of it, which makes sense. And I think there was a podcast I listened to with the founder of Outreach, and he was talking about how they went through like a long ideation, find product market fit journey. And eventually there was a sales manager where Outreach was out of commission for some period of time. And the manager called the founder and was like, you better get this fixed immediately. Otherwise I'm canning this entire product. And his response was, he was so excited because he knew that if somebody is that pissed, if the product's not working, then it's no longer a nice to have, it's a must have. And being able to keep that afloat becomes critical. Not that we have ever had a production outage, Satish, but like certainly there's something to be said about like if people aren't able to get into your application and make the change they want or do the development that they want, it becomes a huge bottleneck in what should be the lifeblood of an analytics operation or any platform that you invest in. So that's always I always think back to that anytime there is some type of delay with like a release we're trying to get through or something. There's always a bright spot.
We get a lot of requests from our customers. That's a good sign. I'm constantly.
Exactly. Like anytime you've got a community of customers who always want new stuff, always want new features. Like it shows they're so engaged and invested in your company's success and the product. Last couple questions. I know we only got another 5 minutes or so, but just again, shifting into the putting your VC hat on, thinking back, looking at companies historically that you've worked with, what are some of the biggest mistakes you've seen companies make or founders make? Is there any common pattern? Or are there any certain things that you've seen be detrimental?
I mean, I would say that the majority of companies that fail for team reasons, like usually, especially at the early stages. And luckily the fact that you two had worked together for a long time, like made that a non-issue for me. As companies mature, honestly, the number one thing is just execution. So the teams that can execute, once you have product market fit and you have an exciting market, it's just about execution.
Yeah.
I think if I kind of like break down that answer, there's like a few components there. I think one is as a company grows, kind of like not keeping the end customer in mind and expanding into a bunch of different product areas where the product ends up being shallow across multiple areas and like the value prop kind of decreases. The second is that I've sort of seen is kind of teams building out like a massive sales team before they've sort of like learned how to build like getting true product market fit and making sure that they can sort of sell their product in a specific use case on a repeatable basis. That's another one that I've sort of seen. And just on the execution point, just making sure that like everyone does what they say they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And that goes for the product engineering team, that goes for the sales team, that goes for the customer support team. And in the world in the past, like, I mean, we just came from one of the biggest times where just a tremendous amount of capital was being pumped in. You could miss on those and still get away. I think as the market is contracting from a fundraising perspective, those excuses aren't going to be as looked on favorably enough.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've raised three rounds now, seed, A, B. I think each one being in a completely different environment. Like seed was peak, or at least almost the peak fundraising. Series A was like right after the crash, like in the summer of 2022. Series B recently. And each time my perspective going into it was different than what it actually ended up being. I think going into it this time, I didn't realize to what degree things had changed since the Series A. I guess given it's evolved a ton, like venture capital has definitely become a lot more critical on metrics, not just growth, but sales and marketing spend, burn in general, just so much more efficiency that's become a big focus. Do you see that staying the same for the foreseeable future? Do you see that evolving and shifting in any way? Like, I doubt we'll ever go back to a similar phase to 2021 or early 2022 is just my gut feel, at least not anytime soon. But like,
I can promise you that it will happen again.
Yeah. I mean, probably be a while though, don't you think?
2021 was interesting, but it's still like the Diet Coke compared to 1999.
Yeah.
So like yeah. We will have other cycles. But I think that the companies that are built after those big boom cycles tend to be built for the long run because yeah. They're forced out of necessity to be more efficient, to focus on what matters. And a lot of the companies that raise a lot of money in the boom cycles wind up getting crushed. I mean, I forget the name of the company, but there was one in TechCrunch that just got announced as, you know, selling, you know, having a post of 8.5. Yeah. Post of 8.5 billion or something and selling for 100 million or whatever. So I'd rather be built just after the boom cycle and then hopefully have an IPO in the next boom cycle. You know, that's the dream.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feel grateful to be able to pull off the round that we did in the time that we did. It's just not like fundraising announcements are coming out often at all right now. If anything, it's articles like the TechCrunch article you're talking about with Lacework, just a huge, huge miss. And so it's an interesting time. So what about you? What's your outlook on it? What do you think is the foreseeable future? If you take AI and data outside of the picture, just venture capital in general?
I think in some ways, because there's so much pressure on cost, like people, like I remember people just sort of saying we need butts in seats, right? Like we just need people here to do a job. Yeah. And over time, the quality of talent wasn't there just because you're trying to get something done. I think in a world where you've got a lot more constraints, the bar has to be raised. The same person needs to be able to do 2-3 people's jobs, right? And they need to be able to figure out ways to do everything more efficiently. And you end up with the word I'll use is Spartans, like these Spartan warriors across every function that are just like, they know what the grind's like. And then you end up kind of having a team that's what you need and like can out execute anyone. Like capital is just one form of resource, right? talent is another, and technology is a third one. So in some ways, you're kind of like immobilizing two, where you lack of one. And I think the two are more sustainable over time. Capital will come and go in waves based on cycles, and so that's something you can't control. But I think in general, the level of team and the quality of the product is something you can. And as long as that's kind of getting elevated, I think that is in these environments that sort of comes out and shines.
This is a great spot to stop, guys. This has been awesome. Just to tie a knot on it, go out there and be a Spartan. This is from Soth himself. I certainly agree. I think an A-plus player can be as productive as 5 or 10 people who aren't as talented in that role. And they can certainly punch well above their weight class and move in massive ways as long as you get the right folks. So the Spartan's a great comparison there. It's been awesome having you on. I love the conversation. It's like nice to shift gears from a bit from interviewing different co-founders of companies and actually talking to the companies that actually fund these businesses. So also just a great perspective. It's not like your guys' whole jobs are to think about this stuff. So it's been awesome having you both, Joe, Saad. Thanks so much, guys. And thanks everybody for tuning in.